Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, a three-tiered church in Rome. Join us as we delve deeper into the history and art of the Basilica of San Clemente that is made up of three levels, ranging from the 12th century to the 1st century. Fears of famine. An official from the Caritas Network paints a picture of the severe hunger crisis in East Africa and says this looming famine is not on the radar of the international community. And the prison of prostitution. Listen to the inspirational life story of a former sex worker who left her job, became a Catholic, and set up a shelter to help others escape from the sex trade. The Basilica of San Clemente is a unique three-tiered church located in the heart of the Eternal City. It consists of a ground-level medieval church that's built on top of a 4th-century church that in turn was built on top of a 2nd-century pagan temple and a 1st-century Roman house. My colleague Lydia Kane went on a tour of San Clemente, and this week she delves deeper into the art and history of this church in the second of our three-part series. Her guide for this tour of the church's three levels is the rector, Irish Dominican, Father Thomas McCarthy.
Father Tom, tell me where we are now in the Basilica.
Well, we're standing in the 12th century Basilica just outside the Schola Cantorum, much of which, of course, dates from the previous church downstairs. This was a gift of the Church of Constantinople, as they called it then, to the Church of Rome in the mid-6th century. So we're standing here in the nave of the 12th century Basilica, looking at the extraordinary mosaic of the cross as the tree of life, and the branches, the other branches of the tree, taking in all manner of human beings, animals, plant life, all the world that was, if you like, saved and redeemed by Christ's sacrifice on the cross. Beneath that world-famous mosaic is a fresco right around the apse of the 12th century Basilica, a fresco showing the risen Lord with his mother and 11 disciples. Now, this is where major restoration work is going to begin, we're hoping, in the next few months. Lydia, we need to get that done. There is dehydration, there is humidity, I should say, downstairs, and as a result, frescoes like this are susceptible to damage over time, but we'll have to get that restored.
That must be such a constant thought, because once you have one thing restored, there must be something else that needs to be restored.
Very much so, and behind us is the chapel dedicated to St. Dominic, which obviously dates from only after the Dominicans became the proprietors here, and that recently was a two-month-long restoration project, magnificently done actually by Luca Pantone. And yes, there are aspects of the lower basilica and of the excavated areas in general, including lighting and clearly signalled pathways, all of that. So there's a constant to be done sense about San Clemente. It's not lying still, it's not an old historical place that is not going to change. It's still a living fabric and a basilica where the liturgy is celebrated each day. And in fact, when it comes to the Lenten station in San Clemente, we begin in the lower basilica. And this year it was Cardinal Walter Kasper who led us in prayer and preached here at that pulpit.
It's interesting you should mention, you know, moving on, because despite what you may think in its majestic beauty, and you think it's, you know, it's hundreds of years old, going back, and yet you talk about modernity. You talk about it actually is, it's not something that's lying still. It's not something, you're talking about lighting. You're talking about new things being put into it for this century.
That's right. The difference is as big as the difference between, let's say, the Roman Forum and a basilica like this. The Roman Forum is history, but there are no shops there. You can't buy anything now. It's just a historical evidence of the early Rome and its marketplaces. Whereas this is a basilica that still has the liturgy celebrated. People come here specifically to pray and to worship and gather together in the growth of their faith. So they're coming here not to look at the place as just a relic, but rather to move into it with their own questions. And that's one of the things that I've found if I'm dressed in the habit, as I am now, walking around the basilica, people will come over to me and ask me questions in whatever language they think I know. And of course, people will also gain, during a pilgrimage or a short tourist visit to a basilica like this, people gain the courage to ask a question they mightn't have had the courage to ask their own priest at home about some religious fact or fiction or about some mystery of the church or its faith. They'll ask, they'll be willing to open up and share the questions they have. So that's part of the pastoral ministry of just being around here, Lydia.
Now, dare I ask, do you have a favourite part of this basilica?
I do. Let's walk in that direction.
I'm curious.
It's a wonderful painting of the Mother of Jesus done by the Italian Sassoferrato. He did a number of them, and they were very popular. He did a number of them that were almost identical. And one of them is actually in the National Gallery in London. But here, over the altar in the chapel of St. Cyril and Methodius in San Clemente, we have the Madonna of Sassoferrato. Today, what we're looking at is actually a photograph. The painting itself was removed last week for restoration, and it's a superb photograph.
It's a very good likeness, I have to say. You wouldn't know.
Placed in the frame that the painting is normally surrounds. It is, and this is a place where also you were talking about East and West church dialogue, because in the marble casket underneath the altar here lie the relics of St. Cyril. St. Cyril and Methodius were named by John Paul II as co-patrons of Europe in 1981. They were Greeks who preached the gospel in so much of southeastern Europe. And we'll see the evidence downstairs in the lower basilica, where there's a shrine in honour of St. Cyril and Methodius, of the devotion in which they are held by people from Bulgaria, Hungary, Macedonia, Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia, all of that area, where Cyril and Methodius did some preaching. They were 9th century Greek preachers of the gospel, but they brought back to Rome what they believed to be the relics of St. Clement, the third successor of St. Peter as Bishop of Rome at the end of the 1st century. And tragically, Cyril died quite young during that Roman visit, and the Pope said, Cyril will have to remain in Rome after what he's done for the church in Rome by bringing back the relics of St. Clement. So that's how St. Cyril ended up, not here, of course, but in the lower basilica, which was then a larger, wider basilica than this present one, actually, the lower one was.
Now, I'm right in saying that this basilica is, if we were to think of a cake, it has three layers. This cake has three layers almost.
That's true. So far, shall we say, we have found three layers. All we know, of course, is that the lower level, the lowest of the three levels, those are buildings that date from late in the first century, shortly after Nero's fire. So if we were to dig further down, you would, of course, find ruins, partially preserved walls and floors that predate the fire. But we don't know in what condition they would have been, because this area was badly affected by that fire.
An archaeologist's dream, basically, to delve further into the history of the church.
Very much so. And including the history of painting and the kind of frescoed work that's done downstairs, as we see on the walls. Yeah, there is a great variety of things to attract. Plus all sorts of manner of little items that were found in the course of the excavation.
That was the rector of Rome's San Clemente Basilica, Dominican Father Thomas McCarthy, interviewed by Lydia O'Kane. You can listen to the third and final part of this special series next week. In Ireland, special collections at all masses were taking place during the weekend of July 22nd and 23rd in response to the dire humanitarian crisis in East Africa, where millions of people are threatened by famine. The money raised will go to Trocara, the overseas development agency of the Catholic Church in Ireland, a member of the Caritas network. Paul Healy is country director for Kenya and Somalia with Trocara and recently came back from East Africa. He told us he saw significant rates of severe acute malnutrition among the local population there.
Trocara has been working in this region for decades now, but I've been working here for 20 years. I've rarely seen it as bad, if ever. And the United Nations has described this as potentially the worst humanitarian crisis the world has ever faced since the end of the Second World War. I was up in Turkana myself in northern Kenya the week before last, and we're seeing significant rates of severe acute malnutrition and global acute nutrition rates way above what would be a normal crisis. Meeting children coming into health centers with their parents who are emaciated and the children emaciated. So frightening scenes that are largely going unnoticed, particularly in Kenya. I suppose it's gone below the radar, but also I've been into Somalia too. The stats there and the human misery is just appalling.
That was Paul Healy of the Irish Catholic Development Agency, Trocara. We now move to Australia for an inspirational story about a former sex worker turned campaigner against prostitution. Prostitution is often described as the oldest profession in the world, and it's arguably one of the most despised. But sex for money exists no matter where one goes in the world, and statistics show that in many countries, business is booming. In the UK, for instance, the number of men who frequent sex workers has nearly doubled in a decade. We hear nowadays how a growing number of those working as prostitutes are the victims of people traffickers who have forced them to become sex slaves. But what about those who have chosen this profession? What are their feelings about their job? And what is the church's response to prostitution? Well, I've been finding out more.
It was an abusive life. It was a soul-destroying life. You hate your clients. I hated doing what I did.
Linda Watson is a former prostitute turned campaigner who worked in the sex trade in Western Australia for 20 years, initially as a prostitute and then as a brothel manager or madame. After quitting her job at the brothel, she set up Linda's House of Hope, a shelter that helps other girls to leave the sex trade and start a new life. In 2003, she was named Australia's most inspirational woman by the magazine Women's Weekly for her work on behalf of others. Linda first got lured into the sex trade by the promise of high earnings when she was an impoverished single mother, struggling to support three children. She told me more about her first impressions.
My first client, I guess we always go back to the first client, was a high-profile media executive. I was quite amazed that somebody so powerful, so rich, and in such a high position. And I thought, oh, I had from the butcher to the baker, right to these high-profile people. But I guess you soon learn that most of them lack integrity. 99% of them are married. And you think, wow, hey, what's marriage? There is no trust. Why would you want to get married if your man's going to go to a brothel, huh?
And what were your feelings about them? I mean, did you sometimes feel sorry for them? Did you despise them? Did you fear them?
I guess you switch on and off. I think you learn very quickly that you to survive, you're going to think, I'm just doing this for the money. You know, you could be reading the paper almost. It's just such a cold transaction. So you're not really trying to focus on the person that you're with. You're focusing right at the beginning. We're going back to my beginning thinking, this will make money. I'll do this for a couple of months and I'll get out. And there lies a real danger too, where you just totally switch off.
So you never came across anybody who treated you with even a slight degree of respect?
There's a lot of people who were very, very nice. Also, I learned that they were very insecure and, you know, I'm not a man-hater. They also hated themselves for having to pay for it. I guess underneath, they had a problem. There were nice men who would talk to you. There were men who would cry because their wife didn't understand them. And so you think, oh, poor person. But really, the underlying thing is the fact that it was deceitful and they lacked integrity. That I learned very quickly, and I got very disillusioned. The reality is nothing like the Pretty Woman movie.
Linda says the sense of shame was so strong that she tried to conceal what she was doing from those around her.
I mean, I concealed it from nearly everybody that I could think of. I quickly got a nanny in. The money was rolling in. I mean, I was supposed to earn $2,000 a week. I earned $5,000 in my first week. You're certainly not going to tell your kids. But then you sort of think, right, I feel so dirty. And I remember coming home showering, had so many showers because I felt so dirty. And I certainly lost that part of even being a mother because I even when I went to cuddle my kids, I felt so guilty. So I really did shelter them until they were old enough for me to tell them because I was really concerned that there would be somebody that would tell them.
Linda originally only intended to work as a prostitute for 2 months. But as she explains, once you get sucked into the sex trade, it's very difficult to escape.
It was very difficult to get out because the money entrapped me, the lifestyle entrapped me, and I guess I lost who I was. I lost my my self-worth. I mean, I knew it wasn't right when I went into it. I went into a whole different sort of a world.
Drug use and prostitution each tend to fuel the other. And Linda says a very high percentage of sex workers become addicted to drugs.
98% of the girls that are working are on drugs. If they come in clean, they're certainly not going to stay clean for very long.
Why is this such a problem?
Because it's an emotional job. It's also the fact that these girls are doing 8 to 15 men a day, and some are doing 20 clients in one shift. So they are needing something to fuel their bodies so that they can continue to do the job. That actually gets them to stay in the sex industry.
But although the vast majority of prostitutes do find it very difficult to leave the sex trade, Linda was able to buck that trend. She told me how one day she decided she'd had enough and wanted to start a new life.
There was a lot of aspects for me leaving the industry. My mother's prayers, for start, she prayed for me for 20 years. She never stopped praying for me to get out of the industry. And I had so many bad experiences. And when Princess Diana died, I guess that was a pivotal moment that I thought all the money that you can make isn't going to make you rich. I guess there was a whole pile of issues of seeing all the pain and hurt in people's eyes over 20 years and my own pain. I asked for God to help me and his guidance that night, I think August the 31st, 1997. I just said, God, if you're really there, reveal yourself to me. And I couldn't put it more clearly that I cried out for God to help, and he did.
But what was so unusual about Linda was that once she left the sex trade, she didn't forget those she'd left behind. Instead, she decided to go back and rescue others from the sex industry.
I had a passion on my heart, and I guess the other side of it as well is 20 years, who was going to employ me? I was 42 years of age, and I wasn't ready to lie down and not do anything. But I guess the defining moment was that what can I do with my life and what purpose can this serve? And I guess the biggest thing for me was that the government was about to legalise prostitution in Western Australia. And that was the pivotal moment that I sort of said, right, this isn't going to happen. And from there I had a burning passion to save others and to warn others not to do that. Don't go down that path.
But, as she told me, trying to find support and backing for her idea of opening a shelter to house former prostitutes proved incredibly difficult.
Difficult was an understatement. I had banged on doors for 2 years, and I got to the stage where I sort of went to every possible places that I could think of that I could go, and every door was closing. You know, people were starting to even laugh at the fact that I was still continuing my search for this dream or vision. And I said, I have this passion and vision that I can provide a home, I can do something for people, but everybody's shutting the doors in my face.
But one day, a door was not banged shut in her face, and Linda was given that vital helping hand.
I could not believe how he welcomed me with open arms, and he believed in me, and he believed in my vision, plus fighting against legalisation. He was an answer to my prayers.
The answer to Linda's prayers came in the person of the then Archbishop of Perth, Barry Hickey. It was he who helped her to set up a shelter for former sex workers. Here's his side of the story.
Linda rang me, almost in desperation, saying I was a madam and I pulled out of the industry and I want to rescue girls. Can you help me? I immediately said, I don't know how to help you, but I will help you.
Was it an easy thing to do? Were other people trying to dissuade you from it? I mean, how did you go about it?
Well, I waited for 2 weeks and said I'd call you back, and I did. And by then I'd resolved that if she needed accommodation, I would provide at least one house, and we've been able to do that. And now she has a second house, which is the house where the prostitutes mainly stay. But there was some surprise, a lot of surprise. Some people shook their heads and said, what's he getting into? But generally, the support has been great.
And what have you learnt on a personal level from your involvement in this project and from your talks with these people who are trying to escape from the world of prostitution? I mean, has it sort of broken down, shall we say, some stereotypes that many of us may harbour about these women?
One of the things Linda has always said is that there is no glamour in prostitution. And I've found that out too. The lives of these girls are anything but glamorous. I've discovered that most of them have entered prostitution against their will. They themselves have been abused in many cases and have very low self-esteem. I've also found out that my opinion of men generally is not that good. They exploit these girls to cross every section of society. Most of them are unfaithful to their wives. It is not a good scene. There is a lot of exploitation also by the people who control the prostitutes. So I see it as a grimy trade, and I'm glad Linda's there rescuing these girls.
In Britain, Dr. Elaine Storkey is a well-known Christian author and sociologist. She has done several studies on prostitution and has been involved in faith-based projects to try to rescue sex workers from the trade. Elaine believes the Christian churches often have a tendency to be too judgmental when it comes to the issue of prostitution. Instead, she says, what is required is a sense of compassion.
Why is it that they're trapped into this lifestyle? Why is it that they have so little respect for their own bodies that they're willing to use them in this kind of way? And I think just talking to women and trying to give them more self-respect and more body sense that's positive rather than negative is also what we can do. I think where we failed a lot is just simply seeing prostitutes as immoral people whom we need to legislate against and hound out of our patch. They're real human beings with great needs and often very bad backgrounds, and we need all the compassion we have to actually work with them.
Elaine told me how even a single kind gesture can succeed in reaching out to what many perceive as hardened sex workers.
There was one project in the UK in an area of London well known for prostitution, where a bunch of churches decided to get together and on Christmas Eve go around all the known prostitutes in the area with a rose, a single red rose, and not with a tract and not with a complaint or anything, just with a rose to say, this is Christ's birthday, we want to share something of what we feel about Jesus Christ and with you, and then leave the rose with them and wish them a happy Christmas and go away. And one of the women who had received a rose spoke to me, and she said it broke her heart. She had no idea that the God that the church believed in was a God who actually loved her. And she had that rose, and she said when it died, when it finally died, she just wept and wept and wept because somehow something of herself had gone into that rose. So I think a lot of women are feeling very negative about themselves in the job. A lot of them are struggling to get out. A lot are very, very defensive because they feel they're being judged by others. And then a few do feel that this is a perfectly okay lifestyle and they're going to stay with it. It's very mixed.
Returning to the situation in Australia, how does Archbishop Hickey evaluate the Catholic Church's response to prostitution? And how much help does it provide to those trying to get out of the business?
I would say that only on an individual level is much else being done. Occasionally a prostitute will approach a priest or a convent for help, but that is rare. I think Linda's project in this part of the world is the main contribution that the church is making by supporting her.
So in your view, a lot more could and should be done?
Yes, I think government and the community generally should support efforts to rescue these girls. The scene here is very different from trafficking that goes on in third world countries or from third world countries to Europe. We have some trafficking here, but not much. Most of the prostitution is by local girls in local brothels controlled by local people.
And when it comes to the men that use prostitutes, is the church speaking out enough against the fact that they should not be doing this, that they are exploiting these women?
I do use opportunities that come my way in the media to say those things, but generally prostitution is glamorized. The image of a prostitute is one who is wealthy, who is having fun, and who wants to be where she is. It's a completely wrong picture. We're doing something, but we're not getting enough publicity, because I don't think people believe us.
When you say you don't think people believe us, what do you mean by that?
I mean that they think that if the church speaks out, it's just speaking out about outdated moral code. But when people get close to prostitutes, they see that their lives are very sad indeed. We have very little legislation, so prostitution is on the rise, but we want better legislation to control it, but not to license it.
Why is prostitution on the rise, in your opinion?
I think it's the general culture of the country, where personal freedom is emphasized to such an extent that prostitution is seen to be a man's right, and it's mainly men who look for girls. It's just part of the general culture that people can do what they like and nobody should put up any moral barriers. Also, it is not generally understood that the girls are harmed by prostitution and exploited, and that's the message we want to put out there to men.
Perhaps not surprisingly, Linda's courageous decision to help rescue girls from the sex trade has earned her many enemies among her former associates in the business. She told me how on numerous occasions she has risked death because of her stand.
When I first left the industry, I spoke to a madam and she threatened me and asked me to leave town, and this wasn't going to happen and she wasn't going to stand for it. And then I got shot at. I've been shot at, firebombed, threats, nearly kidnapped, people nearly through my roof. Can't count the death threats. It's been horrendous.
But you're carrying on.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have my dignity back and I have something worthwhile fighting for, and I believe in what I do.
But regaining her dignity and self-respect is just one of the rewards Linda has found in her new life. A Catholic convert, Linda says her greatest moment came when she met the late Pope John Paul during a visit to Italy in 2004.
Well, I met the Pope. Wow, that was just the best reward that I ever had. I just felt like, oh my God, I'm standing here right in front of the Pope and here I am. It was just like redemption for me. I just felt like Mary Magdalene standing there in front of the Pope. That was my greatest overwhelming, and of course I'd won the most inspirational woman of Australia, and that didn't mean as much as meeting the Pope.
That was the voice of Linda Watson, a former sex worker turned campaigner. And you also heard the voices of the Archbishop Emeritus of Perth, Barry Hickey, and Elaine Storkey, an expert on prostitution. And that's all we have time for in today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.